sentiments. They out of tune and sharpened by the artist who neglected it. I'm scarred by my resemblance.
Silly thing that I do to feel like paralyzed. I dream when I smile, scrambling for a hint of hope.
One, we're a rabbi and imam and pastor walking to a bar, discuss what happens if the casket's dropping. The one inside committed suicide, family spastic sobbing. The answers coming, more flavors than Baskin Robbins. Will God forgive them for the sin, or will they ever make amends? Or was it the last option up of the path they walked in? Depending on if they believed in hell or heaven, or if there was a chemical imbalance in their cerebellum, or if the pain was overwhelming, full of self-loathing, feeling plagued by failure like the first male chosen. Or what if hell's frozen and life was only this purgatory full of greed? The murder war, see, I know you heard the story. What if they wait and have faith to reincarnate? With luck, they won't again be stuck between a rock and hard place. Running in the hamster wheel, we wondering what answers real in stargaze. Pray someone above to keep our hearts safe.
Silly thing that I do to feel like I realize that dream.
The barrels cry, wishing they could spare your lives. Was feeling paralyzed, but no, I wasn't scared to die. Feared not living to the fullest, so I pulled it. All or nothing. Now somebody wanna call my bluff when I tried to flinch. Told them that the suicide attempt was, cause I'd rather die than live and ride the bench. For every victory, there's like 50 times a setback. For every revolution, there's a death trap. And every time I see police attacking with a taser, gonna protest it, it's down already on the ground. My face is stunned. I see people that's unaffected, like that's just for safety, hun. Turn around and tell myself, you're not the crazy one. To all the unfazed and numb, hope that you hear. But I've spoken, it's clear. So you stop repressing, choking the tears. But y'all walk the line between insanity, insanity, and hope and despair. Hope and despair.
I'm as big as the sun in the sky. My dreams and my denies. Slow, raw, and numb outside. I dream in the snow. I dream in the snow. Winter cold.
So the next one is the social model. Has anybody ever heard of the social model? Yes. Do you want to stab at a definition?
Sure. It's a recognition that sometimes the environment is actually disabling the person.
And yeah.
And so, and it takes, it's not a person who's broken, it's sometimes the environment which disables you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, and it was developed in the 70s in the UK by a bunch of radical, physically disabled, white, straight dudes, mostly. And they separated out impairment from disability. So impairment is what the medical model definitions are of people. But disability is exactly like what you said, where disability is the oppression put on top of impairment. So a common example is impairment is that you don't have legs. Disability is that there's no ramp, so you can't get into a building. And so this was really, really changed the way that disabled people saw themselves and saw organizing. So up until that point, there since 1880, there have been disability groups that have been doing organizing. But up until that point, it almost always was around specific diagnosis categories. So, and little pockets of them. So there's a group of deaf people organizing over here, a group of blind people organizing over here, a group of people with CP organizing over here. folks with spinal cord injuries organizing over here, and not a lot of dialogue or perceived common interests in between them. There are a couple exceptions to that where people have come together around disability legislation. So when Nixon was president in the States, people coming together to fight Nixon, but then kind of going back to their own things, or would have gone back if not for this new idea of disabled people are people who have oppression imposed upon them because of their impairments. It was a really revolutionary way of seeing things. It focused primarily on people being able to access paid employment, and yeah, it was. It meant that disabled people could come together around that shared identity, and begin to challenge, particularly the charity model, but also to a lesser extent, the medical model, or at least the way that medicine was attributed to all of the problems that, or the medical model that disabled people faced. So rather than talking about the fact that you didn't have legs, you would talk about the fact that there was no ramp, and increasing demands on society to recognize that there were structural barriers that needed to be dealt with. Yeah.
Is this when occupational therapy becomes a thing?
I don't know that much about occupational therapy. I just know a little bit about rehabilitational therapy, which started after the Second World War. And the idea around rehab or rehabilitation is really like rehabilitating you to what you once would have been or were. And it really came out after the Second World War because there was a huge mass of newly disabled people. So the idea was helping people develop to what they were before they were disabled in the war. And it rapidly grew as an industry and was expanded to people who had always been disabled. And that there's a core element in it, that there's an essential human that's not disabled within each of us, and they have a moral duty to really draw that out of people and make people as human or as close to human as they possibly could. So it's like married within the medical model, but it certainly has its own ideology and approach to dealing with stuff, but uses medical tools to be able to achieve rehabilitation.
I just want to add one thing too around environment. It has a broader definition too, not just built environment, but environment can include other people's attitudes, technology, culture, you know, so it's broader than just built. And I think those are all very
absolutely. And there's an ongoing debate within the social model, because originally it didn't actually mean that, and so there's been ongoing discussion around what barrier is, people with intellectual disabilities and psychiatrized people were just kind of thrown in to the social model, and they're like, yeah, you're included, and then they added them to the list without actually really thinking about or talking to those groups of people. And so there have been lots of criticisms of that model. One is that it doesn't give people space to talk about their bodies, and to talk about hard times that they have with their bodies, I'll just start with the radical model because I have a hard time editorializing on the social model. Another criticism that I have of the social model is that it separates disability and impairment, where impairment is a biological reality and then disability is a social construct. So kind of like how in the 1970s, second wave feminists separated gender and sex to be able to focus on the social construct of gender and not have to deal with the biological realities of sex. At some point, people started looking at that dichotomy as a false dichotomy. Does anyone know that argument or want to throw it out around the sex and gender binary? No.
Wait, as in the second wave feminist argument?
Against it.
Yeah, I'm going to be against it.
Yeah.
Well, just that sex is also a social contract.
Exactly. And the reason that it's a social construct is a lot of reasons, actually, and we don't really have time to get into radical sex ed. But they, a lot of those same arguments apply to impairment, disability. So while on the face of it, I think a lot of people would easily be able to distinguish what certain impairments are, other impairments are not so clear. And what actually is going on is that all of us have cultural biases. And if we're doing science, we apply those biases to the questions that we ask, and then to the conclusions that we draw about them. And some of those things are really obvious. So psychiatry has often been criticized as a tool of social control. There was a psychiatric illness during American slavery that was people's propensity to run away. And the cure for that was to cut off people's toes. And the only people that were ever diagnosed with it were slaves. And homosexuality, again, also clearly about social control. Vegetarianism has been considered a psychiatric illness. And then with the body, there's a number of similar examples. So one of them is the diagnosis of dwarfism. So you're considered to have a diagnosis of dwarfism if your height is less than 4'10", unless you're from a cultural group who are typically short, specifically if you're indigenous to Guatemala. Then you're not a dwarf if you have a height of less than 5'10". That's clearly a cultural construct, and that people have decided what is normal and what isn't normal. But the reality is that human beings are incredibly diverse, and if we killed off everyone who was under 4'10" tomorrow, then we would have a new normal. We would have a new average height. And then we'd have a new group of people that were the bottom 3%, which is actually what dwarfism is, or the bottom 1.2% of the bottom 3%. The bottom 3% are a different diagnosis. But then we would have a new group of people that fall in there. Yeah?
Yeah, this friend of mine is a doctor. He's 5'6". And in the States, they don't treat, they won't pay for treatments of people who are short with human growth hormone. And he said, like, he read a letter, I think in JAMA or something, he said, and he's 5'6", right, which is short for a male. And he said, you know, the shortness is not a disease, so why would they pay for it? You know, it's, you know, but just because you want to be taller, I mean.
Yeah, but shortness is a disease, and there's a name for it.
But there's another, it's idio something shortness.
And that diagnosis actually expanded dramatically right around the same time that the synthetic version of human growth hormone came onto the market. So up until that point, they extracted human growth hormone from the pituitary glands of cadavers. A number of people died from Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. They banned it, the synthetic came on the market, and then the definition of who was that kind of short broadened. And it's increasingly broadening. For the treatment of shortness, costs about $50,000 an inch in height. There's no evidence that kids who are incredibly short have any psychological trauma to that unless their parents pursue treatment. Then there is evidence of psychological trauma to those kids. It has a lot more to do with their parents than it does with them. But yeah, it's completely about both culture, but also whose interests are at play and where psychiatric pharmaceutical companies' interests lie, we tend to see an increasing medicalization of certain types of human behavior when we see certain new psychiatric drugs come on the market. Did you have your hand up?
Okay.
So yeah, certainly all of those things shift and change over time, but also with the interests of capitalism and with our culture. And disability is defined as being in relation to the norm, so a lack of functioning in relation to what's considered normal functioning for a particular age group. And that's why most times when they're doing studies of disabled people, they only study people between the ages of 15 or 18 and 64. Because once you're 65, then it's actually normal to have the restricted functioning that you have at 63, but at 63 you're disabled, and then at 65 you're normal again. And so all of those things are determined by arbitrary boundaries, and they're determined for really specific reasons. So anyone want to venture a guess at why certain people would be classified as disabled or abnormal and others not? Yeah?
Insurance.
Anything else? So, yeah?
General fear in society of becoming disabled, even though it's a reality that one, you know, I forget what the statistic is, but, you know, pretty much all of us are disabled at some point, love things they mentioned, so it's just a general fear that, you know, that becomes a reality.
Yeah, for sure. And certainly the belief that we have control over not becoming disabled, and in doing that we establish what is as being, because as soon as you establish someone as disabled, you're establishing yourself as not disabled, right? Or if you're establishing someone else as abnormal, there's a normal that you're establishing at the same time, and so many people want to be a part of that. Yeah,
that story you had about the doctor was looking through primary diagnosis all the time. It seems like that's like very related to the social aspect of not just about disability, about anything that's different, you know. If someone finds out that you're like a Jew or a Muslim and you're in a hegemonic Christian society, it's the first thing you start to think about everything about you. So like, what was that first? It's like it's a prison. Everything goes through it. It's like a fetish or a fixation. It's a social issue as opposed to like a medical one.
Yeah, totally, absolutely. Did you have your hand up? Sorry, did you have your hand up?
I was sort of thinking of it in terms of like educational models, and so say you have two kids with say like similar levels of ADD, but one of them happens to be in a school district where they have smaller classes, they get more individual attention because everybody gets more individual attention, they're less likely to end up on an IEP than a kid who's in a school where they aren't getting the attention they need in the regular class system. But they could be at the same level.
Yeah, totally. So it depends on not only on you, but on who's viewing you and determining what you are. And back to the two things that you guys were saying around insurance and around a lot of people becoming disabled at some point or getting that identity imposed upon them. There's something called moral hazard theory. And what that means is that it's an insurance company theory. That if you make the money that you get off of insurance really low and make getting injured really, really, really horrible financially, not just any other way that it could really suck, then you're gonna stop people from committing insurance fraud. So if people link a level of desperation and tragedy to financial tragedy, to disability, then they're going to not seek that. So that's moral hazard theory. That is a symptom of, I think, one of the broader things going on around the causation of disability. So I would argue that the reason that people are identified as disabled is because they're perceived to be deviant. And they're perceived to be deviant almost always in our society if they're unproductive or underproductive within our formal economy. Which doesn't mean to say that people can't work, at all, because people can, but many disabled people can't work in the way that our economy is structured right now. And so because they don't fit into the box that capitalism has given them, then there has to be a punishment for that. So moral hazard theory is kind of imposed on many, many different people who don't fit into that box, in order to keep everyone who does fit into that box in the box for as long as they can. And then it's okay if when you're old, you become less productive and you retire. That is an acceptable way to approach it. But anyone outside of that, there has to be consequences to it. And the consequences are really vast. So disablism, like we were talking about before, has huge amount of impact on people's lives. And I don't think I'll get into all of the many ways right now, but like other forms of oppression, is very all-consuming in people's lives and in society, which doesn't mean that everyone who experiences disabledism experiences it in the same way at all. But it is a very profound form of oppression, like any other. Did you have your hand up? Sorry. Okay. Anyone have anything, questions, comments at this point? Okay, so I want to move on, and I just want to ask, because there's a few different directions that we could go. So who here would say that you're an activist or do political work? Just out of curiosity. Okay, then that's the direction we're going to go to. So do you guys, what kind of work do you folks do? Anything else? Come on, guys. Yeah.
Very broad equity.
Pardon me?
Very broad equity.
Solidarity and abolitionism.
Prisoner solidarity and
abolitionism. Can I just put
you
in prison?
There you go.
Does that include fighting for farms?
Yeah.
Anything else that people do?
Yeah.
Gender justice, gender equality. Anyone do bike activity?
activism? Yes. Anyone to... It's pretty comprehensive. Anyone do anything else? Yeah.
So it's sort of anti-capitalist, but anti-neoliberalization of our university.
Can I just say
anti-neoliberalism?
Tuition. Anti-globalization and students. Anything else? Yes.
Fat phobia.
Okay, so this is actually a trick question. Written down somewhere else, I have the real question, which was actually, what work is disability important to or integral to the kind of organizing? And so this is the answer. But let's maybe go through a couple of different ones, just randomly, that I won't choose biasedly at all. To kind of talk about how radical disability analysis or incorporating both disability politics and disabled people is essential to that work. Does anyone want to choose one that we could do?
I think the prison one is kind of
okay. So, does anyone want to throw out an answer?
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I just this is backtracking too much, that's cool. But like in the radical, can you talk a little bit about in the radical model, like labeling, like either like self-labeling, like self-identifying, or like how that like works, like how do you see that working?
Yeah, for sure.
If you can do that after, that's cool.
Yeah, let's do it after, but yes, absolutely. We'll do it right after this. Anti-prison.
What's your question, sir?
How is incorporating, or like, why is incorporating disabled people in disability politics integral to doing anti-prison work? Yeah?
Huge percentage of our inmates have disability issues, have poverty issues, have backgrounds of abuse, have that list there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And anything else? Yeah.
Let's see, prison is probably a good place to be put under an amount of pressure that would bring out things that would be considered disabilities that you wouldn't necessarily get in a less toxic environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else? We have psychiatric prisons. We have institutions that many people with physical or intellectual disabilities are forced into that are designed like prisons and that people consider to be like prisons. And so drawing those links are really important. Also, in prison, disabled people frequently can't access programming, which means they're less likely to get early release. They frequently do harder time, they do more time, and are more likely to do time again. So if you're doing anti-prison work, working with communities of disabled people is really important. Disabled folks oftentimes are put into maximum security, even if they would otherwise be considered minimum security, in order to get programming. So they are, or if they're giving programming for stuff around, or for specific to people with intellectual disabilities, they'll do it at a maximum security level. So that they only have to run the program once, which means that people who aren't maximum security are put into that prison for that programming. So this is a really good one to start off. Let's do one other one, maybe two, really fast. Anyone want to choose one? Yeah.
Queer and trans.
Okay, so why is it that really important? One. So why do we need to include disabled people and disability politics into queer trans organizing? Yeah.
Well, queer and trans identity up to that being marginalized, and so that is already considered by some to be a disability and something incredibly stigmatized.
Absolutely. Anything else? Yeah.
Ensuring that like queer and trans safe spaces are safe and accessible for everybody, not just the able-bodied queer trans folks.
Yeah,
and that, like, that you are not exclusive, and that disabled folk are queer.
Yeah, totally. And oftentimes, disabled people are desexualized and degendered, and so the lack of recognition in the queer and trans community of disabled people who are queer and trans is really, really problematic and really hard for a lot of folks. Also, homosexuality was taken out of the DSM in 73 because of the incredibly disablest campaigning of the mainstream gay rights movement, which actively stigmatized many disabled people in order to become not disabled. And I would really encourage folks to look. There's a This American Life about that, and it's really interesting, so to do more reading about it. And then there's an ongoing debate about whether or not trans is a disability that's happening in a void without any kind of disability analysis. So it's constantly happening in this way of like, I'm not disabled, there's nothing wrong with me. Instead of questioning the structures that allow the creation of disability, like homosexuals, like women did before that, rather than working to overthrow those structures, working to access privilege by reinforcing it against others. So not saying, I'm not disabled, there's nothing wrong with me, saying there's nothing wrong with anyone who's identified as disabled, and working from that standpoint. Which brings us into identifying as disabled. So there's a lot of different politics around who identifies or doesn't identify as disabled. I would argue, from a radical disability perspective, that anyone is identified as disabled who's identified as disabled. That disability isn't a label that we have control over. It's a label that's imposed upon people, with some really important exceptions, like we talked about before, about people trying to access access diagnoses and being excluded from that. And so in addition to people who are identified as disabled are disabled, people who identify or claim that identity are also disabled. And it's that's my perspective of who would be considered disabled. It doesn't really matter if you choose not to call yourself disabled, because that's not going to affect whether or not you experience disablism. It's not going to reflect any of your lived experiences, even if you have what's considered like a non-apparent or hidden disability, you still come up against disablism. But within like what queers did and what women did, there's also that debate within what many people would consider the disability community. So specifically, there's a couple of communities, deaf people and psychiatrized people, who have taken themselves out from under the disability umbrella. Deaf folks argue that they're a linguistic minority. So they don't hear, but what their common characteristic is that they use sign language, and that they have a shared language in which they actually face no barriers in communicating.
That would only be people who know how to communicate with their hands, right?
Yeah.
With sign language. If you become, there are people who become deaf later on in life, and they probably just write things back and forth.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not, you can't assume that because someone's deaf, or,
yeah.
you know, people ask me if I can sign, I thought, well, can I speak Russian? I mean,
yeah.
I'm not hearing aid, that doesn't make me able to sign.
Yeah, and if I had just written the last paragraph that I spoke, I would have written it with a capital D, which obviously you couldn't see because I spoke it. And there is a distinguishment within the deaf community between small D and capital D, and capital D being the cultural or linguistic group, and small D being anyone who doesn't hear, basically. So yes, there are lots of people who don't hear who aren't capital D deaf. And there are also people who hear who may be capital D deaf. Children of deaf parents who are a part of deaf culture, who sign, who are embraced within that culture, are, by some people's definitions anyways, capital D deaf. So they're a part of that culture. And then the other group is psychiatrized people. And before, when we were talking about how psychiatry is a form of social control, that's one of the primary arguments why psychiatrized people have taken themselves out of the disability umbrella, saying that there's nothing wrong with us. We experience the world differently. We're rebels. We are targeted for whatever reason to be controlled by psychiatry. And therefore, we're not disabled. And there is a very active anti-psychiatry and or psych survivor and or psych consumer movement that actually does a lot of really important organizing. And there's lots of books available that you can seek out and read about it. Again, my argument to both of those communities is that it's A, very problematic to reinforce that oppression back onto people that they're leaving behind, and that there's nothing wrong with anyone who's labeled as disabled. The problem is with the system that disables people. So rather than compete against each other for resources and for political power, I believe that there needs to be a coming back together of everyone who is labeled as disabled to actually fight against the systems that allow that to happen. And particularly with the threat of medicalization or the relabeling of disability to a couple of groups, the mistakes that I think were made in the past by women and by homos are at risk of, because they didn't deal with the capacity to be medicalized in the first place, are at risk of having them relabeled as disabled. So anyone want to venture a guess as to why women or homosexuals or queers might be relabeled as disabled?
Well, if you look at like the impairment versus disability kind of model, it may not be an impairment, but there are still things in society that are going to cause problems just because of the way things are set up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
We're also still deviant.
Yeah. But I think there's a something that could happen. Did you?
I was just going to say a certain segment of the population is able to garner more political control. I would definitely see it happening, like the evangelical Christians, fundamentalist religious people in general.
Yeah. Totally, and certainly they've aligned themselves with members of...
They've been close a few times already.
It's true. And a number of psychiatrists who believe that that homosexuality is a mental illness have aligned themselves with evangelical Christians in a campaign to re-label homosexuality as a psychiatric illness. And in part with the belief that cure can be gotten through prayer. But there's a couple of specific things that have happened in since the 80s that really put people at a more precarious position. And They're all through, did you have your hand up?
Okay.
They're all through reproductive technologies and prenatal testing. So what we've seen happen is both the pursuit of the gay gene, which could then re-stigmatize gay people as disabled or genetically deficient, and then we could see prenatal testing and screening to ensure the abortion of gay fetuses, which I think is preposterous, and I don't, whatever. Like, but I think that's certainly something that people are working on. And then with respect to women, both because women, because of new reproductive technologies, women are had a lot more eugenic pressures put on them in recent decades, and women are expected to get prenatal testing, and there's a lot of pressure on women to have abortions if they have defective fetuses. So that's one thing. The other two are the declaration of menstruation as a disease that can and should be cured by some doctors. And then also the sex selection of female fetuses. So while male fetuses can also be sex selected and aborted, in practical terms, that really isn't happening. Female fetuses are being selected for and aborted, so given the same treatment as disabled fetuses. And that's not to say that women shouldn't be able to access abortion. They absolutely should whenever they need or want to access abortion. But it is to say that the resources that we're putting into prenatal testing are incredibly problematic and frightening. And the repercussions for certain communities around these technologies could mean that they end up back under the disability umbrella. Yeah.
Also, I think with the development of climate change discourse entering society, some aspects of that which are returning to like Malthusian like population control theory as like whatever the easy solution to a problem that's not even understood or something, like that it's almost been almost jumped upon by people who already wanted to say that is that happened, but that's sort of hearing more and more people talk about that as a sort of progressive measure or something.
Yeah.
And it's entering the left, which is almost one of the scariest aspects of it.
Absolutely. And that's another point where the population control issue is a eugenic issue. The populations that we're working to control are not white, rich populations. They're poor, racialized populations. And feminists, mainstream feminism, has been complicit in that project. And oftentimes has been active in working to bring birth control to the developing world, which is only being brought to the quote-unquote developing world, to the third world, because governments are paying for it as part of a eugenic project. And then with climate change again, that becoming a solution, but the populations that are being targeted by neo-Malthusianists are, again, racialized, poor populations. And they're not the populations that are causing the most carbon emissions by any means. They're not the populations that are using the most resources. A Canadian uses like 30 times what somebody in the global south uses in terms of resources.
A lot of the arguments that they can't go through the industrialization phase that they're about to.
Yeah.
Well, people spend a lot of time trying to figure out who's going to do that next and how to stop them.
Yeah. So I kind of, anyone have any questions, comments? So we don't have very much time left, and I want to talk about accessibility because obviously that is kind of important around disability stuff. So first off, maybe like what kind of stuff would be included in accessibility? children. Come on.
Like physical support?
Yeah, so. An example?
Like ramps, like infrastructure, I'm not sure how.
Great. Other stuff would be, yeah.
Transportation.
Yeah.
Financial costs.
Like in terms of having being paid for and not being paid for. Like pay what you can?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Visual and auditory.
Sorry?
Visual and auditory.
Yeah.
Access to food and specialized.
Okay, you guys are awesome, but you totally wrecked this exercise. So what's supposed to happen is you guys are supposed to all list ramps, interpreters, maybe attending care, maybe large font, like physical things, and then I'm supposed to go, well, what's it matter if something has a ramp, if it costs $10 to get in, that's not accessible, or if people don't have access to food, what's it matter if a building is accessible, that's what I'm supposed to do, and you guys skipped ahead, so, well done, but when I talk about accessibility, I talk about radical accessibility. So it's not about ramps, interpreters, things that should be there and should have always been there. It is about those things, but it's also about all of the kinds of barriers that keep disabled people and other marginalized people from being able to participate in spaces. And I'm talking, when I talk about accessibility, I'm talking about actual real spaces. So, does anyone know what universal design is? Do you want to try?
I guess just the idea that, like, a building, for example, is designed to be accessible to everyone at, like, every stage of, like a life. So that, like, door handles aren't round ones, they're the ones that can be folded, as well as having like an automatic button to open them so that a variety of bodies can use that door.
So a universal design is architectural or other forms of design in order to make things accessible to everyone at all times. Bit false. And that, while I think that it's important to be architecturally accessible, what's it matter if this building is designed by universal design standards and it costs, I don't know how much, but in Toronto it costs $3 to get here and $3 to get home, so I can't actually come if I don't have the money. It's irrelevant how this building is designed. It's irrelevant if I don't have childcare. It's irrelevant if I'm a person of color and the streetcar driver won't stop and pick me up, like happens in Toronto. So without actually looking at what actual access needs are and oppression, including the lack of physical access, we don't actually have access. We only are inserting people who are the most privileged of disabled people. And it's important to insert those people, but it's important to actually create spaces where people aren't only able to access them, that they're welcome and they're wanted and their contributions are considered necessary to those spaces. So that's radical access in a really quick nutshell. Yeah?
I always look to the accessibility along what you're saying is quality of opportunity. That's like what you said, that's wraparound. So who cares if the building's accessible so you don't have childcare? So having those same, because there's differences between quality and equity, but the quality of opportunity. And what would that world look like?
Yeah, and Yeah, at this in this world, equality of opportunity is pretty problematic. But in a different world, it would be awesome. And but in this world, because that just doesn't exist, and so when people implement equal opportunity, it becomes very hard for actual people to access it. But I think in a different world, the world that we'd all like to see, that's absolutely what we would need. There was something else that I wanted to say about radical access. It's just completely escaping me. Anybody know what it is? Yes.
I don't know if this was said, but I think a lot of like just attitudes towards each other. I mean, obviously, but I mean, no matter, you know, you can be really committed to radical access, radical disability, but like, you know, if people are going to get into something weird and then be like, oh, or like people react strangely or something, like, I don't know, I think an assumption of ignorance and like an assumption of like, you know, people not necessarily being out about disability or just like, you know, every understanding that everyone knows themselves best. And, like,
yeah. Totally.
I know, just non-judgmentalness, usual.
Yeah, and like creating access for actual people, which actually means negotiating things with each other. And one of the things about building a community is about getting to know people and their needs, recognizing that they change, but also learning how to make things as accessible as possible for people.
Just like on even the structural physical level you were talking about, like I'm even looking at this room and thinking of like on the lecture halls and stuff, and it's like just because I can get into them, it's like there's still a designated place where I sit. And I remember even like there's like at like Burger King or McDonald's or something, there's like one table that has a picture of a wheelchair on it. And stuff like that is like not accessible.
And oftentimes those tables have one spot for a wheelchair and then a chair. And so like two people that use wheelchairs can't eat together. And like this building, the law school in Toronto that I've been to is actually designed opposite, so that you can get to the back, but you can't, if you use a wheelchair, get to the front. So the assumption built in that if you're a teacher, you don't use a wheelchair. Only students would use wheelchairs. But one of the things that people do to use an excuse to not make things accessible is that there's competing interests. And so because there's competing interests, let's not do anything. So frequently, blind people's interests are weighted against wheelchair users' interests. So blind people oftentimes use detectable warning strips, which if you've ever been on the subway in Toronto, it's that bright yellow strip before the drop. And it's about a foot wide, and it has a texture to it, so it's little raised bumps. So if you're using a cane, you feel the texture, and you know that you're almost at the edge. And wheelchair users, so blind people use detectable warning strips. They also use curb drops to determine when they're on a street. So a flat sidewalk onto a road would be really problematic because many blind people wouldn't be able to tell that they're in the middle of the road and then would be in danger. But wheelchair users would need a flat surface onto the road. And so that's why certain spots have curb cuts and others don't. But one of the reasons why people use an excuse not to put a curb cut in is for the safety of blind people. But detectable warning strips could be put in at every curb cut, and then blind people and wheelchair users would be able to access the street. But instead of letting blind people and wheelchair users talk to each other and figure that out, which was a conversation that probably took a minute, they just are like, oh, you need this. No, we can't do anything. It's just going to be bad. And so while sometimes accessibility needs appear to be competing, I don't really believe that very often they are. And when they are, conversations and negotiation can figure them out, but many times people use that as a reason not to try. And it's really important that leadership come from the people that are impacted by those needs differences. Do people have any last-minute questions? questions or comments or things that they wished were covered that I failed to? So one more thing about, oh yeah.
I was just wondering if you knew about the sort of politics of accessibility within the Ontario Building Code, and it's a really complicated debate, I think, in a lot of ways, because certain things that are demanded by the Building Code are so difficult to do that a bunch of people who might have done them don't do anything becomes so expensive. But you also don't want to do something that's like not good enough.
Yeah.
But it you know what I mean, like the net effect is sometimes worse.
Yeah. So I've not read the Building Code. What I can tell you is that there's something called the Ontarians with Disabilities Act. And that's a law that's going to make stuff accessible by 2025. and that's why I'm in a group called DAM 2025. And not everything will be accessible by 2025. And so, like, you know, some governments signed similar legislation in the late 80s, and it came into effect in the early 90s. In Canada, it was signed in, like, 2001. And comes into effect like 25 years later. And the other thing about that is in Toronto, you have to get a permit to build a ramp. And you have to get an architect to do an architectural diagram. And you have to do all this stuff. And it was quite expensive to just go through the permit process. So I had friends who built a ramp so that our friend could come over and hang out, and so there would be like an accessible house in the city that wasn't her house. And the city threatened to shut it down and put a stop work order, which could have resulted in like a $25,000 fine. And so we worked with the city councilor a lot to try and the impasse that we came to is basically like, okay, you guys will be quiet and we'll be quiet, and we'll just finish building a ramp. But that even something like building a ramp, well, landlords have a duty to accommodate a tenant. So if they have to build a ramp, they actually have a duty to do that. The city actually makes it illegal for most people to build ramps. And that's incredibly problematic. The thing to do about it, cross your fingers and hope that you don't get caught. Like, and also working, because sometimes like a little bit of a angle actually makes a big deal in a wheelchair user's life, particularly if it's a ramp. But like a degree is not really that big of a deal.
Just a question, I don't know if you want to answer, but do landlords have a responsibility to make a building physically accessible when someone with a physical disability lives there? So basically, like, it's those buildings are hard to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. If you have a tenant moving in who has a disability or who acquires a disability, then you have a duty to accommodate them, provided that it doesn't cost too much.
But they only have a duty when a tenant who lives there is disabled.
Yeah, not their friend.
Visit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
No. Did you?
Yeah, because you're right. And you're a carpenter too, with building code, the standards coming from the ODA. Talk about competing interests. They're trying to make Ontario accessible, and we thought the public sector versus broader public, and then the private sector. And they're the ones pushing back the most on the building standards, which is going to roll into the Ontario Builders Code. There's been a huge backlash because the argument that the private sector is going to use is too costly. So it's up to us folk, I think, to organize together, as we're saying, and building a case for why this is an inherent right, and not just a business case that the province is putting out saying, well, we're getting an older population. Chances are that population is going to be disabled and they have a lot of money. So store owner, you know, you should have a ramp because they can come in and buy stuff, and it's a totally bogus argument that I don't like at all. But so it's up to folks that are informed, like you all here, to make a case, a moral case.